On this episode of the New York, New York Baseball Podcast, Wally and I sit down with a trifecta of former New York Daily News columnist Mike Mazzeo. We have Peter Boddy, and we also have John Harper on the program, and we're going to talk about their time at the Daily News, the journalism field going forward, and we're going to talk about the Yankees and the Mets.
Yeah, we're going to, you know, more than anything, we're going to tap into their expertise on the baseball teams, because these guys know the two New York teams better than, or as well as anybody in town.
And we also have a song from John Sterling. Want to stick around for that one, too. The New York, New York Baseball Podcast coming up next. We're back. New York, New York Baseball Podcast. We're in studio. We're no longer in a Comfort Inn.
That was good, man. There was a coffee machine right there.
That place was nice.
I like this. Close to my house, too.
We're back in our Long Island studio. We have a very jam-packed episode today. It's a little longer episode today, but it's a very timely one, because if you're living under a rock in New York, you know what happened to our beloved New York Daily News. It got gutted, especially with the sports staff. Went from 34 people to 9 people. So on this program, we're going to have Mike Mazzeo, Peter Boddy, and also John Harper. Obviously, you know those names in New York. They'll give their side of the story. How they're dealing with it all, and some of their greatest memories, and how they think the world of journalism is going to go forward. Because while you know a lot about this,
yeah, they're also going to give us some insights on the teams that they cover.
Yes,
I mean, these guys know the Yankees and Mets as well as anybody. But it's kind of a bittersweet week. I mean, these are three guys I've wanted to have on the podcast since we started.
Yeah, I wish we could have got them under better circumstances.
Yeah, unfortunately, we have to get them under these circumstances, but they will be great contributors to the show.
So how'd you have your spend your all-star break, and we had a little hiatus here?
A little Jones Beach, a little physical therapy for my knee, a little house painting, a little bit of everything.
Nice. I like that. But I honestly feel like this show could be 4 hours long, because if you just wanted to talk about what's going on with the Yankees and the Mets.
Wow.
You know, I put together a little list of things that have, you know, this is what has happened over the last, like, week and a half. You got Noah Syndergaard's got foot, mouth, and ass disease.
Not what you want
from Noah Syndergaard. He's going to be out for a week. You got Cespedes with his heels.
Okay.
As of today, when we do this on we recording this on what is today? Wednesday. He's out for the year.
He's out for the year.
10 to 12 months. He said not sooner either.
My wife goes and has her heel scraped. She's home in a half hour.
So why can't he go play?
I don't know.
This is Cespedes thing. You can spend an hour talking about Cespedes and how the Mets didn't know about these heels. Did they know about the heels? You know, he just springs it on them. He comes off the DL for being on there for 2 months. He hits a home run against the Yankees, goes back on the DL.
All right, let me ask you this. Does this now make his deal worse than Jacoby Ellsbury's deal?
It's almost equal at this point.
Well, here, this is why I think it's worse. Because Jacoby Ellsbury was never expected...
Right, to be a savior.
That's right. This guy was supposed to carry the Mets, right? Yeah. This is going to carry the offense, and this guy's not even on the field.
Yeah.
Ellsbury's just an incidental guy. It was a dumb move by the Yankees. It was just kind of a makeup move for losing Cano. But I don't think anybody expected him to be like the spark plug of their offense. Cespedes was supposed to be the guy, and he's been nothing.
Yeah, we'll get Peter Boddy's thoughts on that, Mike Mazzeo, John Harper on Cespedes. We talk about that at length. But also, Gary Sanchez. Had a little rough day the other day. He had a bad day at work. He, you know, very rarely do you see a player in baseball, because it's such a team sport where, you know, you don't have that direct impact on a win or a loss unless you're a starting pitcher and you throw a perfect game or something.
Mm-hmm.
But Gary Sanchez single-handedly lost the game for the Yankees the other night by a lack of hustle.
Yeah,
to,
you know,
Ben Stiller in Heavyweights.
Yeah, there's that old saying, you know, you go to the ballpark because there's always a chance you'll see something you never saw before. I had never seen a two-base pass ball before.
And then you got Severino chewing him out in the dugout. And then he goes up in the ninth inning with the game on the line, doesn't bust it out of the box, starts to run. Afterwards,
okay.
He says that, you know what, you know, it's no excuse. He said all the right things afterwards, Sanchez. He said, you know, it's no excuse. I am healthy, he did say, which was, you know, interesting, because now he's on the DL. And
well, yeah, but you
like
have to understand, you know, listen, if you're around players a lot, they are very, very reluctant to admit injury. All right, always. A, because they don't want to be accused of making excuses, and B, because they don't want to be taken out of the lineup. I mean, that's the nature of the beast. But today, he is on the DL. He's going to be out for a month. So anybody out there, I'm sorry, I'm talking to you, my Twitter followers. You know who I'm talking to.
I'm talking to my buddy Donnie Puglisi, who's texting me yesterday.
Any of you lunatics.
That he's lying.
Yeah, would think that, you know, the Yankees don't want to admit that they're benching him. Well, they wouldn't be benching him for a month if this is disciplinary, all right? The guy is hurt.
You know, it had me thinking about the Yankee team and some of the dangers of a homegrown team. There's no track records here, because 3 years ago, Gary Sanchez was the next Johnny Bench. He was the next Pudge Rodriguez. He was the next, Mike Piazza, all wrapped into one with his when he burst onto the scene. Same thing with Greg Bird when he had that big September in 2015.
Yeah, but here's the thing: you don't know what a guy's character is going to be until
That's
you put him
saying.
Out there every single day. And the other thing is, you don't know the durability. I mean, playing Major League Baseball every day is a grind.
100%. That's what I mean.
Yeah, so we see now that, Bird maybe's not as durable as they thought he was going to be, and Sanchez is not the catcher that they thought he was going to be. He's got a great arm and a great bat, but he needs work.
Everyone wants that young team. Everyone wants that team under 25, under 30, but you don't know how they're going to play out. That's why that's what it's like the unknown. It's like the unknown waters where you have this young team.
Major League Baseball, more than any other sport, reveals guys over time because you have to play every single day. It's not like you're playing once a week and you come up with your best game like in the NFL.
Right.
Or even, the NBA, it's a completely different thing. Baseball exposes guys every single day.
And you're seeing it with the Yankees. You're seeing it with, they're still winning games. They're still 30 games over. But five games back.
That's the important thing.
But my main point is that you just don't know what you're going to get. There's no track records. There's like no Mark Teixeira at first base. So when he's healthy, what he's capable of doing. And same thing with a Cano or just a veteran team. You have this young team. So, yes, you want to stay young. But there is that little sense of like you don't know what exactly you're going to get from this young team. That brings me to my next point where I think that that's why you have to strike while the iron's hot. Something that you said.
Oh, I always think the window closes in a hurry.
Look at the Nationals. Remember the Nationals?
Look at the Kansas City Royals.
Yeah, they're now on pace to lose 100 games.
Right, right.
So
they
were
world champions 3 years
ago. You just don't know who's going to underperform. You don't know. No one predicted that Sanchez would have this level of drop-off defensively and offensively. The guy's hitting 188.
Yeah, we haven't even talked about that because his power bat has been good. I mean, he has been productive as a power hitter, but his batting average, which many of the Sabre geeks would tell you does not matter, has been awful, and his defense is just – I mean, people made excuses for him, but he's leading the league in pass balls once again. A lot of pitchers are afraid to throw to him on that staff, do not trust him because they think the ball's going to get past him. And as you pointed out, even Severino got in his face the other day.
I don't know if I'm ready to give up on Sanchez just yet.
No, I wouldn't give up on him, but right. I think his future is as a DH.
That's another thing. I'm glad you brought that up because going into this offseason, the plan was, which I thought was the plan, or at least what I wanted to be the plan, was to get Sanchez out from behind the home plate. Have him catch, 50, 60 games, but have him play first, have him DH. But that all went out the window when they got Giancarlo Stanton. Because that's what I see Stanton. That's what I see Sanchez as. I never saw him as a catcher. Yes, he has that great arm. I saw him as a guy that wants to slug.
Well, let me ask you this. At this point, whose glove do you trust more? Stanton's out in the outfield or Sanchez is behind the plate?
Oh, Stanton has shown to be a very good left fielder, and I have to just say that I was dead wrong on that.
Surprisingly good in the outfield.
Yes, he's actually their most consistent hitter right now outside. It's him and Judge right now because who leads the Yankees in hits right now?
Yeah, but I'm talking purely defensively. I did not think the guy was a good outfielder, and I thought he was definitely destined to be a DH. But right now, I can live with him out there.
Yeah, he's serviceable in left. But yeah, Sanchez, I didn't realize how much of a lightning rod this guy is, because you're hearing all these things. He's lazy, you hear he's fat, you hear he doesn't care, you hear all he wants to do is hit home runs. But I'm not ready to give up on a guy like him.
I'm not making a judgment on whether he's lazy or doesn't care. I don't know him well enough to say that. And many catchers, Roy Campanella was fat. He's a three-time MVP. I don't think anybody ever called him lazy. The thing with Sanchez is I think people see that there's tremendous potential there. The guy's got a gun for an arm, so you don't want to take him out from behind the plate. But, damn it, he's got to catch the baseball.
It's funny. The Yankees put out this – did you see that tweet, the Heart and Hustle Award?
Yeah.
Just
Austin
bad
Roman.
Timing. It's very poor timing, but, you go and you look at every single team, they all put it out at the same time. It's like a generic automated tweet. It just happened to come at the worst time for the Yankees where Austin Roman won the Heart and Hustle Award. And I don't care what anyone says. Yeah, Austin Roman is – the perfect backup catcher, but he is not a starting catcher.
But you must admit he filled in very, very well
yes,
while Sanchez
perfectly.
Was injured.
But give him 600 at bats, he's not putting up the numbers that Sanchez is putting
up. Goes back to my point about how baseball exposes people over time.
Right. And there's this perception that Roman is this wizard behind the plate. He's not really. If you look at the numbers, I think it was while Sanchez was on the DL, his most recent DL stint, I think it was 18 of 21 base runners. Running wild on Romine.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt that the other guy can outthrow him. However,
he calls a good game.
If you, it's not even for the calling game. Don't forget the pitcher is really calling the game, not the catcher. The problem is pitchers rely. Pitchers like Tanaka, pitchers like Sonny Gray.
Of course,
some of the relievers rely on being able to bury pitches in the dirt. And if you can't trust the guy behind the plate to stop them, you know, you've taken away a weapon from your pitcher.
Yeah, absolutely. There is that. Even though I was a pitcher back in high school and college, like, you want to know that if you bounce something, it's going to stay in front.
If you got a runner at third base and an 0-2 count and you want a guy to chase a pitch, all right?
Yeah.
If Gary Sanchez is back there, you're not going to bounce that pitch.
So what's going to happen? And he's eventually going to be healthy. And the way that Gary Sanchez salvages this season and turns it around is if he can have a huge September. And, you know, if the Yankees are lucky, have a very big October. We saw him have a big hit last year in that Astros comeback. I think it was game 4 or game 5 when they had that big comeback. I was just watching it last night. But, you know, he's got to salvage it somehow, and he certainly can because, you know, this team is going to play in October.
Well, he can only do it with his bat, and let's see when he even comes back. Let's see how
he's out
serious.
A month
without a setback, so we'll see. I mean, it's July 25th now. He's supposed to be back by the end of August. Let's see.
Also, while we were away, we also went into the WCBS 770 AM,
yes.
Your old stomping grounds.
Yeah,
formerly
my old studio.
ESPN studios. We were on the Sid Rosenberg show. The Sid
Bernie and Sid.
That was fun.
Terrific. Yes, it really was. It was good, and they were good. It was good of them to have us on too. Help us reach some people who maybe don't know about this podcast.
Yeah, but my main takeaway from that Bernie and Sid little visit we had is that Sid Rosenberg's jacked.
Oh, man, is he? What is he on? He's working out like hell.
He's on that Balco
I'm sure he's purely clean, but, man, he was strong.
Very big for, like, a radio guy.
Yeah.
I was a little intimidated when he came out there. I was like, whoa. He,
really?
And he had, like, he was, like, you know.
I thought he was going to break your arm.
I know. We got to get him on the podcast.
Definitely.
That's the thing, too.
He loves to talk sports, so, yeah.
He's
a
big sports guy,
get him
so,
on.
You know, shout out to Sid Rosenberg and the Bernie and Sid show, everyone at WCBS, for having us on. But let's get into it. It's just heavy on with the New York Daily News sports writers. That's a big story in New York, a big story in the country, because when you see a New York City newspaper shut down, you know, it resonates, because if, like, you know, it's the biggest market in the country. But first, we have Mike Mazzeo, formerly of New York Daily News.
Mazzeo.
Sorry, Mike.
All right, Dan, as we said at the top of the show, it's been a tough week for sports journalism in New York City. The Daily News pretty much gutting the sports section. And, you know, as baseball guys, you know, I think that it's a huge loss for this town, because we lost some really good baseball writers, and we're going to have three of them who were let go this week by the Daily News. We'll start off with the guy who I worked with at ESPN. He was a terrific guy to work with there, and then he became the Yankee beat writer for the Daily News for the past season and a half. Mike Mazzeo joins the NYNY Baseball Podcast right now. Mike, how you doing today, buddy?
Hey, Wally, I'm doing all right. It's definitely different not being at the ballpark, but trying to make the best of it and trying to find the next career move.
Yeah, and you know what? And this is the time of year where it's really busy to be a Yankee beat writer, and it's also, you know, it's the time when you kind of look forward to it because it's trade deadline time. You know, the pennant race is starting to heat up. Things are really going to get interesting after kind of like a meaningless month or two of the season. How do you withdraw from that kind of a thing?
I don't even know, because I think you and I were kind of talking just before the show, and I said this is kind of what you live for. It's like, you know, the controversy with Gary Sanchez on Monday, and then the Yankees make a huge trade against Zach Britton on Tuesday. Now, like, they're about to play right now. I feel like I should be there. And then, you know, the Red Sox counter getting Nate Eovaldi. And all of a sudden, like, all this stuff is building that you go through, all these miserable, you know, April, May, June, all these games. A lot of them are, like, you know, not necessarily meaningless in the standings, but, you know, they're not, like, that interesting. You know, you've done this so many years. You're going through 162-game slog at times. And then, like, given their schedule, they're playing so many bad teams. They're obviously kind of going through some adversity recently.
Right.
So, like, this is the time when it gets fun.
Yeah.
Right near the trade deadline. And then, you know, what players do they get? Do they galvanize the team like last year with, you know, the Robertson and Canely and Frazier, you know, trade that really, really kind of changed the course of their season? So, like, this is the fun time. So to be out of it right now is really weird. You know, even last night when they were getting Britton, I was like, oh, man, maybe I should call, you know, Yankee execs or call
right,
scouts
your first instinct would be, yeah, oh, I got to write something.
Man, what am I doing? Yeah. I can't be sitting here and just watching everything happen. I need to have a column done. I need to get, you know, a news story done, whatever it is, and to sit here and not have to do that is weird.
You know, Mike, I think that's one thing that the fans don't really understand is how much this becomes part of your life, even though, you know, look, it's drudgery at times and it is a job. And believe it or not, fans, there are days you don't feel like going to the ballpark and watching a baseball game because you do it just about every single day. But it does become part of your life. And, you know, your first instinct, obviously, yesterday had to be, I better call the office and tell them, you know, I'm going to write Zach Britton.
100%. And then, like, you're thinking, like, you know, like you said, of all the things you don't like to do, like, you don't like to get up for a 6 a.m. flight after, you know, filing at 1 a.m. or something like that and then barely getting sleep. You don't love to do early stories. Like, that's what it makes to become part of your life. Like, on an every second basis, is because you wake up in the morning, you're like, I got to come up with something. This game hasn't been played yet. What can I come up with that's going to, quote unquote, hold up, as we say in the business?
Yeah.
So that when people in Florida wake up, they can read this story and it's not like, hey, you know, I wrote about, you know, the Yankee starting pitcher that night. He just got shelled. Well, how is he so great?
Right. You know, and somebody in Florida is saying, doesn't this guy even watch the games?
Exactly. Right. So you're always thinking about, what's my story for the day? What's the plan of the day? What's going on in the other teams? What's going on with the Yankees? Let me check the game notes to see if there's any stat I can kind of pull through to get through that. And, you know, who's injured? Who's coming back? You know, how does this affect, you know, this decision affect that decision? Whatever it is, like, you're always thinking about the team that day. And then even when you're off, then you're coming back. So you're like, I better watch the game, you know, the day before I come back so that I kind of know what's going on. Because, as you know, as a baseball writer, when you miss one day, it feels like you missed a week.
Especially the Yankees.
You know, you get a weekend off.
Yeah.
And you missed 3 weeks.
It's like missing a week of grad school, really. It's a lot to catch up on, seriously.
Exactly, exactly. So then you got to read and you got to catch up and, you know, you're always active. It really is your life for, you know, now with the internet and with Twitter and podcasts and all this kind of stuff, it's a 365 day affair. And then even with the players posting on Instagram, who knows, maybe Manny Machado is going to like something, that's going to become a thing. You have to be adept at, you know, so many mediums and platforms and all this stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely a you know, 24/7, 365
I mean, the point is, it's not just, you know, you're not just going to baseball games and having a great time cracking up in the press box. I mean, this is work.
100%, 100%.
Now, Mike,
you know, I think by the end of it, I mean, Christy Ackert, who's still there, she's phenomenal. She,
right.
I mean, that's for us.
Good friend
I
of the show
as well.
I think
her and I were the only two people that were doing, like, early column, late column, you know, running kind of game story, rapid reaction kind of thing we did. And then, you know, a notebook and then a second notebook. I mean, it was a lot of work in that short time, but, like, when you do it so much, you're all right with it.
Yep.
You know, all those deadlines when you have no time to write a 800-word column and you're just going at it and you're not worried, you know, does it read the best? Maybe not, but just get the point across and then get out of there, get to bed, and then do it again the next day.
I'm sure by now a lot of people have listened or seen the rant from Michael Kay on the Kay Show, and I really thought he nailed it. And, you know, he listed a lot of the people that did get laid off at the New York Daily News. One of you, you were one of those unfortunate people. And he actually said that you were in Tampa when you got the news. I mean, let's take us through that, if you don't mind, and, you know, how that all went down. And the fact that you were in Tampa, it's just, you know, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, so I had worked, I think, from, like, July 5th to the Thursday, right before the Subway Series. So that was a really long stretch. I knew that was probably going to be the longest stretch I had to go through this season consecutively. So I went to, you know, I started in Toronto, then we went to Baltimore, then we went to Cleveland, then I covered the All-Star game in D.C. And by that point, you know, of Aaron Judge hitting the home run and Severino pitching a scoreless inning, the Yankees having a pretty strong night that night. It wasn't like, you know, you can kind of just coast through. So by that point, I was pretty spent, obviously. And, you know, doing, again, the two columns and the notebooks and the gamers, like, all that stuff consecutively every day was, you know, a lot. So then I had some time off, you know, obviously had known I was going to go to Tampa. So it's just standard operating procedure. And then, you know, we get our schedule every Friday. So, you know, I checked it just to make sure, because knowing we knew this kind of stuff was going to come down eventually through, you know, back channels. And then obviously the Post reporting it publicly that Monday and Tuesday was going to be the day.
Jeez.
So just checking it, you know, I saw I was going to Tampa still. So it was standard operating procedure. I flew out on Sunday night, had some weather trouble getting in, but did successfully. So I knew I was going to be all right. So I woke up in the morning in Tampa and, you know, obviously a bunch of us, you know, writers on staff started calling each other and, you know, you kind of figure out, okay, am I on the list? You know, okay. A couple people said I am. So I called my editor and he confirms I'm on the list. So I'm like, okay, what do I do now? And so they said, you know, whatever, take your time, whatever, get back, you know, when you can. So I went to the ballpark and, you know, I told Aaron Boone what would happen. You know, he was very nice, you know, very, very, understanding, and said, you know, what are you going to do now? And, you know, I just told him, I said, you know, the only thing I hope is I covered your club fairly. And he said, I don't even know, you know, like he didn't read it. And I said, well, maybe that's true, but you probably do. And I just hope that I covered you guys fairly. That's like all I could have asked for. And, so we hugged and, that was it. And, you know, it was really good to say goodbye to the other riders. Cause I mean, the Yankee beat is a really good beat. Like there's no drama on it. There's just a bunch of professional dudes.
I can second that. Absolutely.
Huh?
I could second that. Absolutely. Good.
George King is super professional. Eric Boland is super professional. Like there's grinders like Brendan Cuddy on the beat who just work their butt off. And so it's a really good group of guys. You know, Pete Caldera has been on it forever. He's like the nicest guy ever. If you want to go out for a drink post game, whatever you need, like he even gave me a ride back to my hotel after the game. Like, these guys are just the best dudes, and you're with them more than your family. I know we always say that a lot, but like, it's true. Like I see those guys more than my girlfriend, my parents, my brother, everything. So, and then I went out with Mark Carrig and Coley Harvey, who's new at ESPN. He does a great job. Like after the game for beers, like those guys are the best. Mm. So, you know, it's a really good beat. I'm really going to miss leaving those guys, but, yeah, it was a weird day, you know, cause you're at the game and the whole Gary Sanchez stuff happens even, and you're at the end. You know, this is my final game, and I'm like, man, I could this column is like it's a layup column, you know, one way or the other, whatever you feel about Sanchez, and then you know, kind of the managerial move to bunt DD and take the bat out of Stanton's hands, and, you know, that whole game, and then Severino struggling was like the perfect column game to write in the regular season. Yeah. Some days you have nothing; it's like a 5-1 loss. Okay, great, the offense didn't hit today. That game, there's like 8 things you could hit.
Mm-hmm.
So to be there and not have to write was weird.
Now, Mike, do you think that now you brought up the fact that, you know, Machado likes something on Instagram, and in today's age, that turns into a you have to write something on that. And I think you did for the Daily News. I remember clicking on it and reading it. And it made me think about, you know, is that kind of what journalism is now going to? I mean, now that we see that the New York Daily News is going to be mostly breaking news stories, and they want to, you know, almost be like a tabloid. Where do you see the state of journalism heading in 2018?
It's a really good question, you know, and I think especially because of what The Athletic has done. You know, at the core level, it was like on our beat even. You had the people like George King who are going to get every little nugget. You know, he's going to write the straight game story. He's going to give you – George's notebook is ridiculous, obviously. He's going to give like a 1,500-word notebook where everything possible that happens at the ballpark that day he's going to give you. And then, like, you know, The Athletic is going to do its thing where it might take, you know, something where it's not something you can tweet. You know, like the Yankees, whatever, acquired Zach Britton. Why is that important? You know, and they're really breaking that down. So different outlets are obviously doing different things. You know, Billy Witz of the Times is kind of a different thing where he goes to goes to Colorado to Goose Gossage's house to kind of, you know, talk to him about all of his comments from spring training.
That must be interesting.
Yeah, there's so many different guys on the beat that are doing different things.
Yeah.
And like, I think kind of at their core, like the tabloids, you know, even Eric, obviously at Newsday, does the same kind of thing as George and I did, where we were kind of, you know, I was obviously writing columns, but these guys are just like, you know, getting everything from the clubhouse that day. So like that daily content kind of allows these other places to go and do their thing. So it almost kind of works together, even though everybody's working separately.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, it's a really good question. Like,
but here's
I think
a question.
A lot of this stuff, you know, in notebooks is probably going to be stuff that's tweeted out maybe. Mm-hmm. And people are going to go more for this, you know, kind of athletic model where, you know, they're doing features. They might not be doing stuff in an 8-0 loss. Like there just might not be anything there that day.
Mm-hmm.
But they're working on some story they're going to put out and get, you know, 10 people on, and maybe they're going to write a couple thousand words.
Well, Mike, here's a question for you. I mean, a lot of times I know it's a mistake to use Twitter as a real window into what fans want or what we should report, but it appears that a lot of people on Twitter think that we're supposed to be fans and that we should be more positive about the team. And knowing that the higher ups at newspapers these days are so concerned with what does traffic and how many clicks does a story get, have you ever gotten any pressure from any editor there to be more positive or write something more from the fan standpoint?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to do
well, that's
that.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Right. Like, no, of course not. Like, my editor there, no, he was really tough on me, but he wanted me to, you know, be tackling. Like, what's the biggest concern that day?
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if the Yankees win a game 10-5, let's say, but Luis Severino gives up 5 runs, Like, the biggest concern is your ace pitcher is struggling.
Right.
Your offense did well. Okay, great. They have a great offense. Everybody knows that. But, like, what's the problems? You know, what is Brian Cashman trying to fix?
Now, I wonder if that's...
how Brian Cashman wakes up every day.
How can I make
my team better?
And just judging, again, from Twitter feeds, which, of course, are a small segment of the population, and often it seems like...
It's a cesspool sometimes.
It seems like it's, like, the worst segment of the population. But just judging by that, do you think that kind of coverage alienates readers?
I think the blogs are great, but I think that a lot of people that run them are fans by nature.
Oh, without a doubt.
And so them getting into the pool with us is weird. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times when I'm writing, let's just say it was Sanchez or Tanaka, whoever it was like these people who are fans of the team that cared are emotionally affected. They're putting their two cents in now too. So they're going to change the way people think. So there's a lot of different people out there who, I don't want to call it influencing, maybe that's not the right word, but you know, they're kind of trying to think how to
well, they write with an I. They say I, you know, they're not informal.
Correct,
they're
not, right.
But they are trying to.
My job is completely different.
Yeah, they are trying to reshape the narrative, though. You're trying
correct,
to tell the truth the of what's happening there. You know,
correct.
You're trying to tell the truth. This is what's happening here. And there are people out there, bloggers, who are, you know...
They say we a lot.
Or team, because they're team-friendly. Yeah, that's right. They think they're part of the team. And they try to
reshape
the narrative.
We got to get a starter here. We got to do this.
Yeah, but and a lot of fans eat that up. They're like, you know, hey, you know, you write about the Yankees. You should be a fan. Well, no, I'm not. I'm here. I'm a journalist to tell you what's happening in this clubhouse. What's wrong with this team? The things you should be worried about. Yes, there were good things going on, but there were also concerns, correct? And that's why Zach Britton was acquired yesterday, because there's concerns.
Right, exactly. And so these people, the people who are doing the blogs, we're kind of helping them too, because without us, they don't have it.
Right, they have no access to the clubhouse.
They wouldn't know.
Oh, I know that.
Like, on the front line,
they don't let bloggers in.
If I write a negative column, I'm going to see the people in the clubhouse. Maybe they don't care. Maybe they do. Maybe they're going to say something. Maybe they're not. But I'm going to be accountable the next day.
And let me just say this. You know, I worked with Mike Mazzeo side by side for many years, you know, going back to ESPN. This guy works the clubhouse. When he writes something, it's because he's talked to a player.
Because he's talked
to Brian Cashman. Because he got a hug from Aaron Boone. I mean, you know, you're not going to get the same thing from a blogger who's sitting in his basement or his kitchen table.
That's why
he's basically
yes.
seeing what he sees on the television.
That's a big thing that people aren't picking up from this. You have people on Twitter, the very few select, that are like, you know what, who cares? You know, newspapers are dying. You know, I can just go on Twitter and see that. But you're absolutely right. There's a human element involved. Like Mike, like you said, you go into the clubhouse, you talk to the players. You know, Aaron Boone, you left a mark on Aaron Boone, and I just think it's just a sad day to see this happening at the New York Daily News, and I do think that, you know, there has to be that human element, like you said.
Well, beyond that, it's not even the human, it's the information element. You know, that's why we have reporters in the clubhouse, because there are things that happen there that the fans don't see and don't know about. Not all of it we can write, but, you know, it does give us a perspective that others don't have. Mike, we've kept you on longer than we expected. I haven't even gotten to the key Yankee question, which is, what do you think the Britton acquisition means for this team going forward?
Well, I think, you know, he gives them a different look in the bullpen, and that's kind of something they probably needed. He's got a power sinker, and look, he's been obviously phenomenal as a closer, so we know he can get both lefties and righties out, which is great. You know, Chase and Shreve had that phenomenal appearance against the Mets when he came in bases loaded, no out, and got, you know, out of it. But obviously before that, Aroldis Chapman couldn't get anybody out, and mm-hmm. he has this knee tendonitis thing. So regardless of if they say, okay, he's fine, the fact of the matter is your closer, who has been absolutely phenomenal, like arguably the best closer this year, is dealing with this injury. He just struggled in a performance, and you know he struggled last year, lost his job.
Right.
So that's definitely something where they looked at it and probably said, if Chapman, God forbid, were to go on the DL, we now can throw in this all-star in Zach Britton, who's had phenomenal success. And so it gives you some insurance there. And then this is another guy where, you know, if in fact your starter goes 4 or 5 innings, you could all of a sudden throw closer after closer. You could go to David Robertson.
It's like an all-star game.
That was my question.
You could literally put out an all-star bullpen.
Do you think this is an indication that they're not expecting to get a real stud starting pitcher in the next 5 days here, and that they are planning, you know, 4 innings of bullpen a night?
It's certainly possible. You know, they've checked on Chris Archer. They've checked on Tyson Ross. You know, Jay Happ is certainly a name that has been, you know, out there. Somebody they could possibly get. I mean, there are options, but obviously they're more second tier. You know, whether it's like a Cole Hamels or Michael Fulmer, those are guys they discussed. I don't know if Hamels will work in their luxury tax payroll, but whatever. These are all guys that are not the Blake Snells or the Jacob deGroms, because as long as Jeff Wilpon owns the Mets, I just cannot see that happening.
That's pretty much the answer to everything with the Mets.
Right. Like that's the bottom line, because like Omar and Cash have a good relationship. So it's very possible, like if Wilpon was removed from the equation, those guys could figure it out.
Yeah.
But I mean, as long as Randy Levine's in the equation and Wilpon and they're those guys, you know, it's the relationship obviously is deteriorated between the franchises and the front office execs.
Right.
And the owners, I just can't see any of that stuff. So, like, unless, like, it's a Carlos Martinez maybe somewhere, the Cardinals finally say, okay, we're done. You know, that doesn't look like the Giants are going to trade Bumgarner. So, you're basically left with these second-tier guys. So, to make a move to create, you know, this monster bullpen like they had last year when Canely was lights out, it's a smart move because you're going a different route. Maybe you don't want to give up your top prospects for Machado. Your offense is going to be fine. I mean, if Stan's going to swing the bat like he has, the offense is going to be
– Yeah, I don't think there's ever been a problem and ever been a question about the offense. They're going to score runs. Obviously, you're going to have nights when you don't. But, yeah, come on, by and large, they're going to be great.
Exactly, right. So it's
Before we let you go, I want Dan to ask – Dan told me he had a great question to ask you before, and he hasn't asked it yet, so ask it now. You know what it was?
Yes, I want to know what you want to tell your readers out there, your Daily News readers. You didn't have a chance to write a goodbye, so it's something I want to ask all of our guests that come on the podcast today. What do you want to say to all your faithful out there?
Just thank you for reading. I mean, regardless of if you agreed or disagreed, a lot of people emailed me, hit me on Twitter, certainly with strong opinions one way or the other, and it meant a lot. Like, yesterday was – it was surreal because, as one person I think that lost their job with me said, it's like watching your own funeral. You know, like, hey, you're going to be fine. Here's a pat on the back. And, you know, I know you'll be okay. But now, obviously, for me, the next step is actually making sure that's the case, like doing the, you know, making the calls, the emails, all this stuff to, you know, editors and people that can help me. But, yeah, I mean, you know, it was a phenomenal opportunity. I had lost my job at ESPN in 2016 when they decided they weren't going to cover the Nets anymore, and I was devastated because I was, whatever it was, 28, 29 years old, thinking, you know, this was the only job I ever wanted. I loved it because it kind of allowed me to not do the daily stuff. I was doing more features, and I was doing more, you know, in-depth kind of stories, which is kind of what every journalist wants to do, unless you're Woj and you're at the top of the transaction game or Adam Schefter or something.
Right, it's like one of those.
You know, having that extra time or that you know, doing that hour interview with somebody one-on-one, you know, that's also what we all want is exclusive. So I had a lot of opportunity there at ESPN at the end to do that. So then to go back into the grind again, but do it for the Yankees, you know, as Wally did so successfully, like this is a team that so many people care about and they're polarizing. It's either you love them or you hate them. There's not much in between there. So a lot of people are going to be really emotionally invested. They were, and we had great runs. We had a great clubhouse of guys to deal with. All the young kids, Judge, Bird, Severino, Sanchez. I mean, a lot of them were super accountable, and they were great quotes. And, you know, I'm going to miss it. I'm definitely going to miss covering them, regardless of what happens.
Well,
I'm going to miss the job because certainly being kind of the voice of, you know, not only the newspaper, but, you know, of the people, masses for the team was really cool. It was a great responsibility. I'm really glad I had it. It definitely made me a better journalist. You know, battling with, you know, King and Sherman, some of the best guys every day. And I had, you know, a phenomenal help in John Harper and Bill Madden and Peter Boddy and Christian Redd. Like, those guys would always make the call for me if I couldn't get something or give me advice or whatever it was. Like, you couldn't have asked for a better teammates. And I had that. So, you know, just thanks to everybody for reading and your comments and everything like that. And hopefully I land on my feet and I'm back at it, you know, rather than later.
I think you will, man. There's no doubt you will hear from Mike Mazzeo again. Thanks so much for joining us today, buddy. Best of luck, and we'll be talking.
Thanks, Mike. Keep on writing, man.
Thanks a lot, Wally and Dan. Take care, guys, and all thanks right. So much for having me.
Thank you, man.
Okay. All right, so that's one guy who lost a job this week. We're going to have the other two in a moment, but I know what he means about, you know, like just now having to withdraw from that life, because it took me over a year when something broke with the Yankees for me to say, hey, you know what? I don't have to worry about this today.
It's crazy. I mean, everyone's been laid off at some point in their life, and a lot of people are like, can we just move on with this? People on, you know, Twitter or that.
But baseball's different because it is something you do every single day for the whole year.
Of course.
And suddenly you don't do it anymore.
Right. Even, personally,
other jobs, you go 5 days a week from 9 to 5 and you go home.
Right.
Baseball, you're there all day long, every day.
Well, something that he said that I relate to, and I think a lot of people relate to, is like when he you know, this thing happened with Sanchez, and he's just like, oh, I got to write about it. Like, you know, when I was doing radio a few years ago, and, you know, the radio station just shut down abruptly overnight.
Yeah.
And the next day on Monday, you know, the Jets played on Sunday, the Giants played on Sunday, had these great losses. I'm like, all right, I got to go on the radio and talk about
it.
But you have nowhere to talk to. So you find a different way to do it. You find a new gig, you reinvent yourself. And I know a lot of these guys at the Daily News will do that. So let's move forward. We got another guest coming up. It's Peter Boddy of the New York Daily News.
You know, if you're a reader of the Daily News, you're going to miss our next guest. The guy is funny. He's probably the funniest columnist that they had, without a doubt, that they had there. And he's also terrific on Twitter. And hopefully he's going to continue to contribute in that outlet at the very least. Peter Boddy joins Dan and Wally now on the NYNY Baseball Pod. Pete, with all these crazy things that are going on with the Mets now, I'm sure you were dying to write a column about Cespedes or about Jeff Wilpon, or just the comedy act that goes on daily over there. Jerry's Familia. I mean, is that something
Syndergaard
you're going to miss? Syndergaard with hand, foot, and mouth disease. I mean, come on. You can't make this stuff up.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You get that, you know how it is, well. You get that itch, right? And it's like when something like, you know, when crazy stuff is happening, and that's the beauty of covering New York sports, right? In those type of situations, you have to kind of dig your teeth into – to a column or to a news story or whatever. You know, it's funny. I said the other day when the Syndergaard illness was revealed, I said the Mets are like that scene from remember that old comedy Airplane where the flight attendant comes on the PA system and she says, by the way, does anybody know how to fly a plane? And that's what the Mets always kind of remind me of, right? It's like they just keep backing themselves into these unbelievable situations, and those are the situations, as you know, that are the most fun to, you know, when you're in this, you know, in the job that we've done for years.
So now with Cespedes, is he's going to be out for who knows how long. We might never see him again in the Mets uniform, but he's got these bad heels. Now, you're very clever. You're one of my favorite followers on Twitter. You know, you hear about these heels. Give us like a headline. Give us a lead. What do you got for Cespedes heels? I'm putting you on the spot right now.
Oh, off the top of my head. I mean, there's probably some sort of pun with like a heel turn or something.
Heel no?
Yeah, right. Heel no.
Heel
no would be
good.
Yeah, that's not bad, you know, or what the heel or something. But
you wrote a good one about Britain last night.
Yeah, right. Britain to the Yanks, right? That's like straight out of 1776.
Right. That's right. That's very good. See, don't give away your stuff for free. I told you this last night, because the Daily News is still going to steal your stuff.
I know. I feel like I just need to go find a job writing headlines somewhere or something and just have some fun. But yeah, I mean, it's a fun business to be a part of, and it's fun. Like you said, I enjoy being on Twitter and interacting with the fans, and not every day is Christmas. You're not going to hit a home run with every joke or play on words that you make, but you'd like to try to have some fun with it.
Yeah, you know, Pete, I've seen you at both ballparks this year. Obviously, you know, we both covered many Met games together, many Yankee games. At this point, which team do you think would be more fun to cover the rest of the way?
I mean, it's different, right? I mean, it's the, you know, if you're into a great baseball story and, you know, actually covering meaningful games, then obviously the obvious answer would be the Yankees, and it's usually the Yankees. The Mets, I've covered teams like the Knicks, the Mets, obviously, the Islanders, the Jets. I mean, there's so many teams that kind of battle for that, you know, the dysfunction factor in New York, and the Mets are, I mean, it's always a fun story to cover when you're covering a team like that, because you really never know what to expect on a day-to-day basis. Like when people started tweeting the hand, foot, and mouth disease with Syndergaard the other day, I was on the other side on the Yankee side, because it was during the Yankees Mets series. And I actually thought like writers were joking. Like I thought they were making it up. I couldn't believe
it was a joke too.
On the other side of the stadium. I felt like I was like, all right, I was bumming that my friend John Harper was on the other side, right. you know, getting to cover the Mets that day, and I had to write a Yankee column.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I think they've retired the trophy for most dysfunctional organization, even, you know, beyond the Knicks. I mean, the Knicks
That's
are dysfunctional
wow.
on the court. The Mets
well,
are all crazy
right,
everywhere.
Right, but I've always said with the Knicks, like, I always felt like everybody else is playing for second, but the Mets are they bring it to a whole different level. The level of, you know, the Knicks are a dysfunctional mess, but the level of comedy and just absurdity with the Mets really kind of always, you know, trumps everything.
Well, if you had to be a fan of one, is it the Mets or the Cleveland Browns at this point?
Oh, I mean, look, the Cleveland Browns are one of the most downtrodden organizations in sports, right? The Mets did actually make the World Series only 3 years ago, which is, when you think about it, it's amazing, you know, how quickly this has kind of deteriorated and really, you know, really just all fallen apart.
You're absolutely right. But, you know, one thing about the Mets, it always seems easy to blame Jeff Wilpon, and I do it as often as I can.
You sure do.
Do you think that's fair? Is it fair to blame one guy for an organizational-wide dysfunction? I mean, maybe it is, and I think I can make the case that it is, but I want to get your opinion on it.
Well, I mean, I think it's like any organization, right? It always starts at the top. I mean, people used to blame Steinbrenner for everything with the Yankees, and people blame Dolan for everything with the Knicks, right? So, I mean, yeah, I mean, hey, if you're the owner of the team, that's the deal. I mean, there's plenty of blame to go around probably with all facets of the operation when it comes to the Mets, especially what's happening right now. But he definitely deserves, you know, a share of, you know, a huge share of the criticism. Absolutely.
Well, you know why? Here's why. Because and you talk to people as well as I do who speak to us off the record who work for the Mets. Jeff Wilpon's hand is in everything.
Yeah, of course. And that's always tough when any owner is, you know, it's like the famous George Steinbrenner line, right? When he took over the team and he said he was going to be kind of a hands-off.
Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
Owner, which is, you know, the classic lines in the history of sports, right. Certainly.
Didn't age well, as they say now.
You hear that Jeff likes to be, you know, or need, you know, feels the need to be involved with all facets of the operation, and that's really not how it's supposed to work. I mean, like, you look at the way Hal Steinbrenner has kind of taken over for his dad, and he's kind of the opposite of his dad in many ways. I mean, obviously, he has a great desire to win and put a winner on the field, and the Yankees don't ever want for anything. But, you know, you look at him, he's not meddling in Cashman's business every day, and he's
right.
certainly not showing up in the clubhouse and talking to players and, you know, giving advice or whatever it is that he's, you know, whatever it is that you know, other people might be doing.
Well, that's my point, you know, since his hand is in everything. If you say you don't like the job Sandy Alderson did, well, Jeff hired Sandy Alderson. If you don't like the job Mickey Callaway did, well, Jeff hired Mickey Callaway because he makes the final decision on everything. If you don't think the Cespedes deal was a good deal, well, guess who signed off on that? So it all funnels back up to the top.
Oh, 100%. I mean, the buck stops with the owner. I mean, that's – look, everybody has their duties, and there's a pecking order and all that stuff. But, yeah, of course. I mean, obviously the owner of the team is the – you know, the ownership group of any team, that's, you know, that's where it kind of begins and ends. And they, you know, and especially if you're going to be involved in those decisions, then you have to be ready for the criticism that comes with it.
All right. So how do you remedy this? I mean, you know, people on Twitter say, you know, can't Major League Baseball force the Wilpon sell the team? Well, of course they can't. Although they did, you know, interestingly enough, force Frank McCourt to sell the Dodgers.
Come
because,
on.
Right. But here's the reason. Because Bud Selig didn't like Frank McCourt, and he likes Fred Wilpon.
Well,
and they
Rob
bailed
Manfred?
Out Fred Wilpon.
What's Manfred's relationship with the Wilpons?
Well, that's a very good
question.
Can't
be one.
But the answer is, if the commissioner likes you, you're not going to be forced to sell a team. And if he doesn't, maybe you will. I mean, is that
right? I mean, look, you would think if it was ever going to happen, it would have been a few years ago when the whole Madoff thing went down.
No, they bailed him out instead.
But they're right. But MLB bailed him out. So if it didn't happen then, I can't imagine. Look, there's a lot of owners that, you know, make poor decisions all across sports. We see it in a lot of places. So I don't think they're gonna force the Wilpons to sell the team because they've made some terrible decisions.
No, and I don't think you can. I mean, you know, incompetence is not, you know, if we were gonna start firing CEOs for incompetence, I think there'd be a lot of guys out of work right now.
Oh, well, there's no question.
Yeah,
about
including
that.
Including one that you know very well for the Daily News.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, Peter. And I wanted to get you on this podcast for a long time. Like I said, one of my favorite sports writers, one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter, but obviously, you know, the unfortunate things that happen with the New York Daily News and what's going on with newspapers in our country right now. But if you mind sharing with us, like, what the last, like, 48 hours has been for you. I know it's a very emotional time for you.
It's been a tough. It was a really tough couple of days. But I mean, I have to say that we all knew it was coming. I mean, it's been building to this now for several years. I mean, I've felt very fortunate to have survived a few rounds of these purges. And you know, and I've seen far too many coworkers and really close friends and colleagues who've lost their jobs over the last several years. I mean, when I started at the Daily News in 1997, I think we had a staff of almost, you know, 80 plus people. Mm-hmm. And after the cuts on Monday, we went from 34 to 9.
We had 80 people in the sports department alone, right?
In the sports department. Oh, wow. When you counted the editors and the reporters and columnists and writers. Yeah. I mean, we had a cast of, I mean, talk about a murderer's row of columnists and beat writers and, you know, just an amazing editorial staff. And, you know, so that to me is what saddens me more even than myself being out. Look, I mean, I worked with Frank Isola and with John Harper and with Christian Red and so many of the other people who got let go, you know, for years and years, you know, two decades with some of these people. And you're with your coworkers in a lot of instances more than you're with your family. You know what I mean? Especially with this, when you're traveling together and things like that. Mm-hmm. And it's such a close camaraderie, and we've always had that at the Daily News. And to me, that saddens me more than anything, because I know what the paper was. I mean, it was an absolute behemoth at one point.
Listen, I'm 31 years old. The reason I wanted to get into sports is a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons is because my dad had a subscription to the New York Daily News. It came to our house every single day. I read it after school. I read it on Sundays. And I just want you to know that you shaped a lot of kids and a lot of people reading your stories.
Well, I really appreciate that, Dan. And I've heard from so many, not only coworkers and colleagues and people from other papers, but a lot of fans and readers who've said things like that to me. And those are the kind of things that mean more to you than anything. You know, the fact that you've actually, you know, maybe made even on the smallest of scales, you know, some sort of impact or whatever. And, you know, like I said, I always have just tried to, you know, carry myself professionally. And I try to have fun with it and try to give a different take and a different voice sometimes. And you know, the connections, and like I said before, like being on Twitter, like I enjoy the interaction, even if it's not always positive. I mean, I enjoy people telling me to, you know, to go to hell or whatever. I mean, I think that's fun. It's all part of it.
Right. Isn't it amazing how much, you know, like total strangers care about your work?
You're getting a reaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always felt like that's the last few years I've been writing columns, and I feel like that's the intent of when you write a column, you're writing an opinion. And the best columns, I feel like, are ones that half the people agree with and half of them don't, because you get that sort of, you know, you get that sort of feedback. And that's always that to me has always been the funnest, the most fun part of it.
But you're someone that's mastered the Twitter, what do you even call it, the Twitter forum. And where do you see journalism heading in New York? Where do you see journalism heading in this country?
Well, I mean, look, I'm not breaking any new ground here by saying that the newspaper industry has kind of been headed this way for you know, a long time. When the internet really kind of rose to prominence in the late 90s, and we started putting everything on the web, and basically we started giving away the milk for free. Once that horse got out of the barn, it was impossible to get it back, and yep. we just never figured out a way to monetize it. And you know, it's been kind of like a slow death, and it's been sad to not only to be a part of it, but to witness it and to see people lose their jobs, and you know, people have families, and you know, this is their livelihood and this has been their life's work and things like that. And that's the toughest thing. So I mean, obviously there's always going to be a market for the information, and it's just a matter of now figuring out a way that, you know, to get it to the public.
And to get people to pay for it. That's
well, absolutely.
The other problem.
And that's the hardest part, because there's so many places now that you can get the information.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's tough. So, I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of websites and doing great work out there.
But
and
this seems like the only business, Pete, where the public expects to get the product for free.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a tough thing.
Like I mean, I go said, to your gas station and well, tell the guy, I'm not going to pay for this anymore. Try it.
Right. Absolutely. And it's, you know, you see it all the time. Like you, if you're on a website and you click on a story and you read three paragraphs and it says to you, okay, now you have to subscribe to read, you know, to read the rest of it.
Hate that.
Or whatever. And some people just say, all right, forget it. I'm not going to do it. And
that's me.
I understand it. And like I said, we've given it away for free now for so long that people now, an entire generation of consumers is now that's the norm to them.
Yep.
And it's hard now to get them to get people to, you know, reach into their pockets or put their credit cards on a website, you know, that takes even a couple of bucks out every month, you know.
Yeah,
it's a tough pill to swallow for us, but it's I mean, that's just the reality of it.
You're absolutely right. You know, Pete, it was later in your career that we found out that you're a terrific columnist. But, I mean, earlier on, you were a hockey guy, and you were co-author of that terrific book about the Islanders, Fish Sticks.
Oh, we need Fish Sticks, too,
still
now.
Still makes me laugh. Yeah,
yeah, it's funny. Alan Hahn, who's doing great work on MSG and ESPN Radio, I just talked to him the other day, and we were joking that, you know, because people say to us all the time, why don't you guys do another book? There's been, obviously, I mean, that was 15 years ago, and so, I mean, there's been so much that's happened, obviously, with the Islanders in that time. But yeah, I mean, I was a beat writer for a few different teams in New York. I've done this now. I was at the Post for 7 years, and then I was at the Daily. I was at the Daily News for 21. So, you know, I covered a lot of stuff in this town. I feel like at one point or another, I covered every team in this market, you know, at least on a backup basis. You know, I was the beat writer for the Yankees. I was a beat writer for the Islanders. I was a beat writer for the Knicks. I was a beat writer for St. John's basketball.
Who's your favorite person to cover?
Yeah, I mean, so I've done a lot of, you know, I've seen a lot, and I feel like I have, you know, I wouldn't trade in that experience for the world, because I always enjoyed kind of being able to bounce from sport to sport and you know, because I do, I love all the sports. Like, I never understand the people who just, you know, who just maybe follow one sport or love one sport, because I grew up on Long Island, and I love all the sports, and I love the New York teams, and I you know, I have a passion for it, and
yeah,
you know, I hope.
Well,
some small way that it was reflected in my work.
You know? Without a doubt, that's what makes you a terrific columnist, because you obviously had interest in everything. But let me ask you this: if later on today an editor were to call you from somewhere and said, "Hey, man, we really want to hire you," you know, and you name your, tell me what you want to cover. Which sport would you pick?
Good question.
That's a great question. I think my answer would be, we all know beggars can't be choosers, right? So, I mean,
it's a hypothetical.
I understand. I mean, look, I love covering, I loved covering hockey. I love covering baseball. So, I mean, I enjoyed covering the Knicks. I don't have a specific one. I really enjoyed, like I said, I think to me, the most fun I've had is these last couple of years writing columns and bouncing around from writing some football columns, writing some basketball columns, writing a lot of baseball columns. You know, to me, that's been the fun part of it. Like I covered the US Open last month. I covered the Belmont I wrote a column at the Belmont for the first time earlier this month. So I enjoyed it, because I always I always enjoyed reading columnists, you know, growing up, like, you know, like yourself, Wally, and like Vic Ziegel and, you know, Ian O'Connor and like I said, Mike Lupica, obviously. And, you know, like, you know, the people that I grew up reading, like to have been, you know, teammates and or competitors with them over the last 20 years has meant the world to me.
Now, Peter, I mean, one of the things I liked about you is that you tweeted the next day, the sun did come up, and you had some humor, and that's something that I think a lot of people look to you for. And I just wanted to give you this forum. You know, you didn't get to write something I asked everyone that's going to come on today. You didn't have the chance to write a goodbye to your Daily News listeners. I know you're going to land on your feet, and one of the reasons I think you are is because you just explained that you can cover everything, and that's something that's so valuable in today's journalism world. But do you have anything you want to tell your loyal New York Daily News readers for the last 21 years?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that to me, the readers are what it's all about. You know what I mean? Like I said to you guys a couple minutes ago, the feedback that you get from people, or, you know, you run into people and people that you know and people that you went to high school with and people that follow you and, you know, maybe weren't, you know, maybe didn't know much about you before you started writing about their team. And, you know, because people want to, you know, they want the information, they want to know about their team. And if they don't agree with your opinion, they let you know. And I love that. And I always love that about the, you know, New York is probably the most unique place in the world, because everybody has an opinion and about everything, and they're willing to share it with you. So to me, for the readers, that was always the best part of it. And I never had a problem with anybody even coming up to me and telling me that they disagreed with something that I wrote, or that, you know, I got something wrong or whatever. I mean, look, you always try to do the best work you can and talk to as many people as you can and be as accurate as possible and as fair as possible. And, you know, sometimes, we're human too. I mean, sometimes we make mistakes as well, but I feel like the readers are what it's always been about for me. And, that's meant the world to me. And to have been able to share, you know, my thoughts or my dumb jokes or my opinions on things with people and have them give me feedback, to me has been the most rewarding part of all of it.
Pete, very well said, buddy. We wish you the best of luck going forward. Thanks for taking a couple of minutes to talk to us today.
Oh, Wally and Dan, thank you so much. My schedule is wide open, so anytime you guys need me on, I'll be glad to come on.
I'm going to call you on my way home in a little while.
Please don't stop tweeting. Please don't stop tweeting,
yeah,
Pete.
Yeah, please.
Sounds great. All right, guys. Good luck with everything. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Peter Boddy, formerly of Daily News and a guy who is going to be missed.
Yeah, I mean, like he said, Swiss Army knife. That's what I think of when I read Peter Boddy over the years. And that's weird. That's something I wanted to ask him, that maybe I can ask Harper coming up next. Is like, you know, people get laid off all the time, but like, you never really know about it. Like, you don't really know. It's not common knowledge. And I wanted to ask how do you deal with something like that? Like, you know, everyone knows that you just got laid off because like you are a sports writer in New York City.
Yeah, it's a public firing. It is.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, you are a public person, so you have to deal with that all those times of doing that. But thank you to Peter Boddy. I know he'll land on his feet, and we're going to move forward here with the program.
You know, Dan, to me there are three baseball columnists in this town that I read all the time. All right? Tyler Kepner, my colleague over at the Times, Joel Sherman, and John Harper. And I'll tell you what, it's just not going to be the same reading baseball. And, I certainly won't read the Daily News because there's nobody for me to read anymore. But without John Harper writing about baseball in New York, I think it changes the tenor of the coverage tremendously. We're lucky to have him on today to talk about, we're just going to get information out of him for free now since
that's the going rate now.
Yeah, for now anyway, until somebody picks him up, as we know they will. Right now on the NYNY Baseball Podcast, John Harper, formerly of the Daily News, joins us. John, how you doing today?
Good, Wally. Thanks for the kind words. Appreciate it. Yeah, I'm okay. We're all trying to figure out what's next.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's talk about baseball first, and then we'll get into that. You know, what's next for the Yankees? They picked up Zach Britton. We know they need a starting pitcher, and they've got Gary Sanchez on the disabled list with an injury that, believe it or not, some fans think is not real.
Yeah, that's not the way the Yankees operate. They're not going to spare a guy's feelings or spare Boone's having to deal with that just because he didn't run out of ball. The guy's got issues with his legs, and we know he has a reputation for being lazy at times, but there's definitely something to that injury. They're not going to do that.
They're in an
interesting spot.
I was chuckling because, you know, when you said they're not going to spare anybody's feelings, one thing Brian Cashman does not do is spare anybody's feelings. That goes for you, me, or Derek Jeter, or anybody on his roster. If he wanted to bench the guy, he would do it.
He's proven that over the years. I think Cashman sometimes enjoys being the bad guy.
He has no problem with it.
No.
Which I think if you're going to be a GM, you got to be that way, I would think.
You have to be, yeah. And that does take some of the pressure off the manager when you're willing to be the bad guy, too, I think. So, Cashman knows how to handle that stuff, and he's not going to – they're not going to make up an injury for Gary Sanchez.
But one of the biggest things I've seen with the Mets and looking across town with the Yankees, the Mets have had so many issues this year on the field, off the field, PR gaffes. And you'll go over to the Yankees, and they have arguably one of their worst days where they most resembled the Mets with the Sanchez debacle and everything that happened with that. But what do? Is they go out and Tanaka throws a complete game shutout, and then they acquire Zach Britton. And now, you know, Brian Cashman now is on a call with all the beat writers addressing the media, getting out in front of it. Do you think that's the biggest difference between the Yankees and the Mets is how they handle these types of issues?
I do think that's a huge difference. The Yankees are much more buttoned up in terms of who's speaking and who's doing all that stuff. And just, you know, one thing Cashman has always said going years and years, that he knows the New York media, basically he'll say, you know, the New York media, this guy's not, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back, but there's too many and too smart to try and lie to him.
Mm-hmm.
So just get out in front of the story, be as honest as you can, and because they're going to find out one way or the other, and that's basically how he goes about his business. And it's a big difference from the way the Mets do. That's for sure.
How do they not learn over in Flushing? I mean, you know, I've heard Cashman say that many times too. He says, you know, you guys are going to find it out, so, you know, what's the point of me lying? The Mets continually try to control their message, and it always backfires on them. Like, I mean, is it because the same guy is making the decisions and keeps making the same mistakes over and over again? And, of course, you know I'm talking about Jeff Wilpon.
Yeah, I mean, I do think most of it goes back to him, and they're, him and that whole, you know, Jeff and Fred, too, for years. They're very conscious and aware. I think a lot of it goes back to being the little brother in the Yankees relationship. You know, they're so worried about their media, their image and all that, especially compared to the Yankees, that they go out of their way to try and get around things. And they also have layers of PR people and marketing people who I think are advising sometimes, and they don't have the same feel for a guy. You know, Jay Horowitz is over there now, and he's kind of being, he's being pushed out, and Jay knows his way around. He knows what you can, he has that same philosophy. I've heard, you know, as Cashman, look, we need to get out in front of this thing. The media is going to find out. The worst thing you want to do is try and cover up stories in New York, because that makes it 10 times worse. We've seen it a million times.
Yeah, but that's my point with them. When do they learn that this philosophy doesn't work? And speaking of being the little brother, they've embraced that role. I mean, they've done nothing to try to change that. No, not once has a Met GM or Jeff Wilpon stood up and said, hey, you know, man, we're in New York, too, and we're going to compete the same way the Yankees do. They've always taken the position, well, what do you expect from us? You know, we're kind of a middle market team, which is BS.
Yeah, absolutely, especially in the last 20-some years since the Yankees started winning championships again. I do go back to the 80s when, at that time, the Mets felt like they had established at least kind of a level footing in that whole thing, because they had the highest payroll in baseball. You know, Klapisch and I wrote the book the year 92. They had the highest payroll in baseball.
Wow. Tell us the name of the book again, because I love it.
The worst team money could buy. Yeah. I know I've had people on Twitter say, you should write that again, write the sequel. I said, yeah, but they aren't spending that kind of money anymore. You know, it's not the worst team money could buy. It's just the worst team, period.
Well, is the difference, John, that you know, they bought out Nelson Doubleday, and obviously he was the one who was a little bit looser with the purse strings than Fred.
I think that was part of it, and Doubleday gets a lot of credit for just being bold in terms of they went and made the trade for Piazza, and Doubleday, I think, had a lot to do with that. But, you know, even in the mid-2000s when they hired, when Omar Minaya was a GM, they were spending big then. You know, when they went out and signed Beltran and Pedro Martinez and made some big deals, Billy Wagner. And it was only then after that, when that run didn't get a championship in 06, and then they had the collapses in 07, 08. And then I guess the Madoff thing changed everything.
I was just going to say that. Does the Madoff, are they using the Madoff thing as an excuse not to spend money?
Yeah, I mean, I think I could say that. I think it had an impact at the time, because I think there was definitely something there. But when you look at, now they have this, first of all, they still get 20, as far as I know, I'm pretty sure they still get $25 million a year in naming rights from Citicorp or whatever it is.
Right.
They got $50 million this year from Advanced Media, MLB Advanced Media, that every team got. Mm-hmm. That's on top of
where
all the revenue and everything else.
Where does the money go?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a fair question. Supposedly, they still have issues in terms of stadium debt and all that stuff. But you know what? Too bad. I mean, the fans deserve better than that. If they can't afford to have it, then they shouldn't have it.
No,
it's not that they're not spending it all now. They're at a reasonable level, but for a New York team, the situation they're in, when you haven't developed players and drafted well, as that's been the biggest issue during the Sandy Alderson regime, then you have to go out and spend in free agency. And they tried to, you know, go in the bargain route this winter. It didn't work. They should be out there trying to sign Manny Machado this winter, but it'll never happen.
Now, I feel like, it's so easy to pile on the Mets, and we talk about Madoff, we talk about the Wilpons, we talk about this, that, and the other, and it's just like, you know, after a while, it becomes almost like, it's almost too much. But do you feel like now with the fans now and with this season that just happened now, based off last year, you know, all the problems that they're having, do you think it's like at a fever pitch right now? Do you think this is the lowest of the low? Do you think that MLB will step in? What's like the resolution here? Or are we just going to keep on talking about the same exact issues every single week?
Yeah, I can't imagine MLB stepping in. If they were ever going to do it, it would have been a few years ago when McCourt was, or I guess it's been more than a few years back, maybe 7 or 8 years.
Well, it was around the same time as the Madoff thing.
Yeah, McCourt was having his issues with the Dodgers, and they stepped in there. And the Mets did get to a point where they were, the payroll was much lower than it is now. I mean, you can, you can justify it just on a strict level what they're doing in terms of if it wasn't a New York team, especially when they say, you know, they'll point to the fact they got to the World Series 3 years ago and everything else. But it does feel like fan unrest is at a high, really, really high level. Maybe it's because with social media, it's just much more visible and much more easily detectable. But it is, fans are, and especially now with this whole Cespedes thing, they're at a crossroads again. And, you know, even before the Cespedes thing, I mean, I've been writing about it for weeks and months that they were, the Phillies and Braves had already passed them by with all their young talent. They don't have that kind of young talent in the system, and it's not coming anytime, well, at least in the immediate future. And that's why I was a proponent of at least looking into trading
I agree with you.
That's why I love John, because he just stimulated like 12 questions in my mind. I don't know which one to ask first, but I mean, first of all, look, you cover both teams. Don't you see the Mets fan base as being remarkably forgiving to this team? I mean, the Yankee fan base, you know, they're DFAing guys, you know, if he goes to an 0-2 count.
Trade Gary Sanchez.
You know, they like go nuts right away. The Mets fans do seem to be, have been conditioned by the Wilpons to believe, well, this is the best we can do. I mean, I understand people are upset on Twitter, but let's not use Twitter as a mirror on the rest of the country, because God forbid it really is. I kind of think that the Met fan base lets them get away with murder.
I mean, there is certainly a segment of that base that is forgiving and just kind of, I think, wants to take the family to the ball game and everything be okay. But there's pretty vocal segment out there too that is trying to put the pressure on. And I know, yeah, you're right. Twitter isn't the best gauge all the time, but
it is a gauge, though.
Even, yeah, I mean, it does give you some representation. And in some ways, I do think that the fans have become more vocal. I think they forced ownership into signing Cespedes when he was. He became a free agent.
100%.
Because I don't know, you know, they had serious reservations about it, which unfortunately are coming to fruition now.
They were right,
and
yeah.
They were right, but they, you know, and look, I wrote at the time, I think a lot of people did, that their offense wasn't, they couldn't win without the guy, so they were in a position where they had to go sign him. But I'm not sure they would have done it if not for the fan pressure that was on them at that time. So in that sense, I think fans can make a difference sometimes.
Do you think now that Cespedes, this deal has turned out to be a disaster, and now you bring up the fact that the Mets should go out and get a Machado, and yeah, they should, because they're a New York team and they're in a big market. But do you feel like now this kind of justifies them not spending any money in the future on this big free agent class that's about to come this offseason?
Well, yeah, they might use it as an excuse. I put it in a different category though. If you're going to spend a free agency, we see the game trending younger and younger. These young guys are coming up to the major leagues more ready to compete at this level. Mm-hmm. And the good teams now have all these young, dynamic players, Yankees, Braves, you know, whatever. But a guy like Machado is 26 years old. That's the difference. Usually in free agency, and Bryce Harper too, usually you're signing guys in their 30s, and that's the problem with free agency. Now, mm-hmm. more than ever, players are on their downside in their 30s. So if you have a chance to get a 26-year-old, that's where you go spend. At this point, yeah, I think that would be great if they do it. But with this whole Cespedes situation, it does seem like maybe it makes more sense for them to go through a rebuild. As they haven't done enough to justify a rebuild, because this group went to the World Series, yeah, but it had two winning seasons. That's all.
Do you think go ahead.
Fans have every right to be frustrated with him, but you know, at some point you have to say, well, what's the best way to compete here? Are they going to be able to compete with the Braves and Phillies in the next years without doing something like doing a rebuild to bring in young talent?
But the Braves did it by a rebuild. The Yankees did it by a rebuild.
If the Yankees can do it, any team can do it.
Yeah, what is their reluctance to do this? They're not going to lose their fan base. I'm telling you, this fan base is bent over backwards and seems to expect disaster. So, you know, it's not like it would be any surprise.
I think they do Yeah, I think they do worry about though. They know it was only a few years ago they were losing before they got to that 15 season, and Alderson was promising that he was, you know, going to create a sustainable contending thing with the farm system and everything else. He didn't do it. And look, everybody but the Yankees goes through pain with a rebuild. The Yankees, painless rebuild.
They did it like overnight.
Painless rebuild I've ever seen. Yeah.
Well, 2016 was tough. 2016 was tough. We didn't make the playoffs.
Yeah,
that was tough.
They already had that young base of talent coming. The guys like Judge and Bird and Sanchez. Some of these guys, the Mets don't have that right now. That's the difference. So, you see the product, the end result. The Astros winning a championship, the Cubs winning a championship. They went through rebuilds, but unless you were in that city, you didn't feel that pain. The Astros for about 5 years were winning, 60 games a year. So, that's what the Mets are afraid of, that to go through something like that. And I don't think.
But it's happening when they're trying to win. That's the funny thing.
Right. you're right.
They're going to win this year. They won 70 games last year. They'd be lucky to do that this year. What's the big deal? How much worse could it be?
I think the fans are smart. Like you said, New York fans are very smart fans, especially Met fans too. In 2016, I'm a Yankee fan. I wanted to trade everybody. I thought that you sell. That's the only way you can rebuild. You know, I'm on the record saying that they should trade DeGrom because the Mets should almost feel lucky that they have an asset that multiple teams want. So I think the fan base, they're smart enough to know that the only way you can fix this right now is to trade away some of these assets you have, and it's starting pitching, which everyone wants.
But you better get the right guys. That's the thing.
True.
Do they have, can they trust their scouts, the same people that have been making these decisions in recent years? I think that's an issue too. And, look what – it was a couple years ago the White Sox traded Sale. And so far, I mean, it's only been a couple of years, but so far it hasn't worked out really, really well for them. You better make the right decisions on guys. That's the key if you're going to do that.
You got to find a Glaber.
What a fabulous point, because let me point out something, and I think John will back me up on this. This is the same organization that didn't think Daniel Murphy was worth re-signing, that didn't see the talent in Justin Turner, and had reservations about Brandon Nimmo. Last year wouldn't even play him when they were out of the race in September. So you're right. The people making the personnel decisions, I have no confidence in.
That's why I really do think they need to go out and bring in a GM from the outside, some fresh ideas, things like that. And I don't know if they will. They're talking about it. I know that. But their culture hasn't really been to do that. Even in getting Sandy Alderson, they kind of relied on Bud Selig to point him in that direction.
Yeah, they forced Sandy on the Mets, didn't they? Selig.
Yeah. But
I don't think that would have been their choice.
They're talking about hiring, or at least interviewing outside. You would think, you'll get some good candidates, I would think, because it's New York and they'll have to pay them. But they're already putting the word out there that it's likely, they're saying that Callaway will be back. Well, if you bring in a new GM, you can't force a manager who has proven so far not to be up to the task. As you have to have this manager back. So if you're really going to bring in a new guy, you got to give him freedom to make those decisions.
Yeah, it's like it's ass backwards. I mean, a GM usually wants to pick his own manager. You don't want to, inherit
in
a rookie guy who, as you pointed out, is overmatched.
Yeah, we'll see the second half. He just doesn't seem to have that feel for New York and for managing that you want. That's the danger in hiring a guy with no experience. And the Mets really did him an injustice by not at least getting him a veteran National League bench coach, because that would have helped in some of the stuff.
Without a doubt. I mean, at least the Yankees also went with a rookie manager, but they had a solid foundation for the guy to manage. It's kind of tough to screw that team up. But, yeah, you're asking a lot of Mickey Callaway at this point to win with this team. Anyway, let me take you across town. Let's go to the Yankees for a second. What do you think the acquisition of Zach Britton means? What does it mean? Does it mean they're worried about Chapman? Does it mean they may not be optimistic about the trade market for a starting pitcher, or are they just trying to, use five closers every night?
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of all that stuff, really. Cashman, he's going to be in on guys, any big guy that's available. He's in on Machado. He wasn't going to go to a certain level with that. But, yeah, I think he's looking at that starting pitching market and thinking there's not a difference maker. I do think maybe he wanted to keep Britton from the Red Sox and the Astros as well.
Smart move.
Those guys, he would have been really valuable on either one of those teams. So I think that was part of it. And, this Chapman thing has to be a little worrisome with the knee. I who knows? I mean, he had a bat out in the other night. This might have been a coincidence, but we'll see. And, if they do get to the postseason, this really does give them an opportunity to shorten games more than ever, and that might be something they need to do, depending on, you know, what they're getting from their starters at that time.
Yeah, I mean, would you be confident, let's say you were the manager of the Yankees, to go into the playoffs with Severino, Tanaka, and Sabathia, let's say, as your starters, and have this killer bullpen behind them?
Well, if you tell me that you're getting the Tanaka that pitched last night,
We saw playoff Tanaka last year. Playoff Tanaka looked like 2014 Tanaka.
You're right, and he does have a. You have to have a certain trust with him, because he does seem to have that big game kind of gene or whatever. But at the same time, he worries me a little bit, because he seems like he's got to be so spot on now.
Yeah.
Because he relies on the off speed stuff more than ever. He would make me a little nervous. And Sabathia, he's got the big game in him too. But at the same time, you know, there are nights when he just looks like he doesn't have it, and you worry about the knee and the weight and everything else. But, you know, you always have Sonny Gray to be the savior, so that could...
Oh, no.
I've never known you to be that sarcastic. Hey, does it work against the Yankees to some extent? I don't think they're catching the Red Sox. I mean, you know, look, it's anything's possible, but, you know, five games at this point with a team that hasn't shown, you know, any weaknesses so far, and as well as the Yankees have played, unable to really close that gap, they're probably headed to the wild card. Do those last three games at Fenway, does it make it more difficult for the Yankees to win that wild card game? Because if they're close enough, you know they're going to go all out that last weekend to try to win the division.
I tell you, that's tricky. That could be really tricky. Yeah, say you're within a game or so.
Yeah.
And are you going to pitch? Are you going to throw Severino on the last day of the year? And then knowing you might have to use somebody else in a wild card game and then get to the division series? It could put the Red Sox in the same spot, though, depending on how close the race is.
True.
I still think the Yankees are going to make it closer. I still think it could come down to those last three games, which it is going to be fascinating because, you know, baseball managers, they don't want to usually take chances, think outside the box and say, well, I'll save my guy for the series. They're going to go with who they have lined up, and that could put a team at a disadvantage. The Yankees were able to overcome that last year. Because they didn't even have Severino start that series. But it would put them at a disadvantage against a team like they could end up facing the Red Sox in the NLDS or the Indians.
That would be wild.
Well, I just got to say, I hope to God you're writing for someone by then, because that's going to be a great final weekend. I'm really looking forward to what you're going to have to say on that.
I would hope so, too, because I tell you, that last year, that postseason – the whole Yankee thing was a lot of fun because it was so unexpected.
Mm-hmm. Especially after game two in Cleveland. I mean, God.
Yeah.
Especially after the first inning of the wild card game, the top of the first.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, the whole thing with Girardi and not challenging. There were a lot of great stories. That Indian series was, it felt like theater from the first pitch almost. And, those things, hey, listen, that's what we like to do.
That's what we slog through the 6 months for in spring training, right? To get to those last couple of weeks.
That's right. A lot of long nights at the stadium.
Yeah. John, before we let you go, you know, Dan's been asking a terrific question of your two colleagues, Mike Mazzeo and Peter Boddy, who were on earlier, and I wanted to ask it of you as well.
And obviously, it's been a tough time for the columnists here and the journalists here in New York City, and you've been with the Daily News forever. I mean, I was reading you when I was a young kid, and that's the reason I wanted to get into sports. But, you know, unfortunately, you didn't have a chance to pen a final goodbye to the Daily News writers. You know you're going to land on your feet after this, but if you want to just give you this forum to, you know, say something to the loyal readers you had over the years with the Daily News.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It would have been nice to kind of write a farewell column because, listen, I always have considered myself lucky to be able to do this. I didn't actually – it wasn't ever a goal of mine to be a sports writer. I was a pretty good athlete, played baseball and basketball. I played baseball in college and kind of just fell into the sports writing. And it's turned out to be, for me, just a great way to make a living. I never really felt like, you know, it's hard work writing on a deadline and everything, but still it's not sitting in an office, which I don't know if I could ever done. Mm-hmm. So I've enjoyed it over the years, got to cover a lot of fun events. And, Listen, the readers are what make it all. It's all about the readers, and that part of it has changed with Twitter and everything else. You get immediate feedback, but I think it makes you better. Some of it's just nasty stuff, and you don't want to deal with it. But people challenge you sometimes on your opinions and your why you're having those opinions, and I think it's great for the business because it forces you to think about things and not just throw something out there and not necessarily hear from it. So you try to grow, and that's what I've tried to do, and it's just fun. It's I think in some ways too, I've had to be evolved. I used to be more of a just kind of let the story, try to tell the story with kind of a viewpoint, but I've had to take stronger stances and be more opinionated because that's the nature of the business in terms of trying to sell, you know, trying to keep the Daily News in business for all those years. That's what the business turned to because the information was everywhere. So you better have an opinion or something for people to reason to read you and buy the product and all that. But I love it. I love baseball. I think it's the best game. I think there's so much strategy. There's always something to write about, even in the absolute worst game.
Absolutely.
And so I've had fun doing it all these years and just appreciate people for reading more than anything.
Now, do you feel like, obviously, this is like a silly question, but you've been with the New York Post, the New York Daily News for so long. It's got to be.
I did work at the Post for 5 years.
Yeah,
I know. I got to remember that a lot of you guys have worked for everyone. Just shows you know how talented you guys are. But obviously, this goes without saying. But you know, what is it when you look at what the Daily News is today? Like, I went to get my coffee this morning, and I picked it up, and it was lighter than ever. I mean, it made me very sad as someone that read this newspaper going back to when I was 10 years old. But you know, how does it feel to see what's happening to basically your paper for the last 20, 30 years?
Yeah, it makes me sad, too, because it was a great paper at one time, and I still have friends who are going to still be there, but even they would admit that it's going to be hard to do. We thought this Trump company was going to be our savior when they came in and bought the paper, but obviously that's not the case. And I hate to see it because now, you know, you went to the Daily News because you knew you were getting top to bottom coverage, and now they don't have the people to do that. So, it's kind of, I didn't think it would happen in New York just because there was such a fervor for sports and for these kind of writing things like this. We've seen it happen in other cities. So, it's really a shame because the more competition there is, the better the coverage is going to be. And now kind of with the Daily News, they didn't even have anybody in Tampa for these Yankee games now, because they let Mazzio go. So we had they were using wire service from the Yankee game. So it's really a shame. I loved my time at the Daily News there, but obviously it's a whole different product now.
Yeah, well, you will find something else because you're way too talented not to. And I'll tell you something else. And that's right. You still have your gig at SNY, so we'll be seeing you
there.
That's
right. No, I'll still be doing some of that. So yeah. It gives you at least an outlet to kind of, you know, have your voice heard or something on this stuff.
Definitely. So, you know what? Look, I'm just going to tell you, the readers are going to miss you a lot more than you're going to miss the readers. That's my prediction for today.
Well, I appreciate it. I've really honestly been overwhelmed by some of the response. You know, we think of Twitter as being the absolute, you know, worst sometimes and bringing out the worst in people. But it's been really great that people have responded and saying, you know, kind things and all that, because you don't hear that a lot.
No, you don't. You don't hear it from your editors, that's for sure. I've always said, you know, your reward in this business is if they send you back out tomorrow.
But yeah, it's been nice. And I'll, you know, I'm hoping, yeah, listen, you've been through it. I'm hoping that you can find some way to keep writing, because writing is hard, I'll say that, but it's nice to be able to do it if you can do it.
Yeah. Well, one last thing. Do you think that, you know, I went to school for journalism. Do you think that the kids now are going to maybe change their mind when they see the type of industry that it is?
Well, anytime I have had young people ask me about it, I say just make sure you know what you're getting into because it's, you know, it's difficult on the writing end now. I think there'll always be something there because whether it's websites or whatever. But I encourage anybody. I said, if you want to write, at least get the training if you're in college or whatever for the broadcast side, you know, radio, right, TV, whatever. Because obviously that's where more of the future is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what I always tell the kids when I talk to a class? You're not going to get rich doing this, but you can have a lot of fun. And you know what? You're not going to be a millionaire, but you can live like one. You're going to go to a lot of events that only millionaires can go to.
They rub elbows with who
and
knows?
Get paid to be there. Yep. So that's the plus side.
So yeah, and you got to love it. You got to love the writing because, you know.
Yeah, it ain't fun. Yeah.
Well, yeah, especially you're sitting there on deadline, and especially, you know, in the middle of a screaming stadium. You better be able to focus and write. But, yeah, I mean, because I know, you know, some young people want to get into it, and they always say, wow, you get to go to the games.
Right.
You find out pretty quick that if you're not into it for the writing and really want to tell the stories, the other part's not going to last very long.
Absolutely right. I tell them that, too. If you're the type that can't sit there and look at that blinking cursor with 10 minutes before a deadline and come up with something, this is not your business. Go into something else. So, anyway.
Right now, that's the only part I don't miss right now.
Right, the blinking cursor on deadline. Oh, boy, the scourge of all of us. John, thanks so much for joining us, man. We wish you the best of luck down the road.
Thank you, John.
All right, thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Class act, John Harper, formerly of the Daily News. He will wind up somewhere.
And Masahiro Tanaka pitches a complete game shutout and a beauty, giving up only 3 hits, 1 walk, and striking out 9. The sun will come out. Tanaka. Bet your bottom dollar with Tanaka. The sun will shine anyway.
I mean, unbelievable.
That's wonderful. That's a perfect upbeat note to go out on this week.
Yeah, so thank you for everyone who was listening. Of course, that was John Sterling closing out a masterful performance from Tanaka. He decided he wanted to sing.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's used that before, but I'll tell you what.
That's a new thing now.
No, he's done it, though. I've heard it.
So he's going to have home run calls, and he's also going to have a personalized song at the end of every win?
I guess only if the pitcher pitches a complete game, which means he probably won't do it again this year.
So it's rare. So you're not going to hear John Sterling sing. You know, he's 80 years old. He just figured, you know what? I want to sing, damn it. I'm going to sing.
I'm John Sterling, and I'll do what I want. And you know what? I'm all for it.
There it is. John Sterling, keep doing what you got to do. This is the end of the program. Thank you to everyone, John Harper, Mike Mazzeo, and, of course, Peter Boddy, for calling in and sharing their memories from the New York Daily News. We'll be back next week with another edition.